This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents It Devours, a Welcome to Night Vale novel by Joseph Fink and Jeffrey Craner, performed by Cecil Baldwin. Not everyone believes in mountains, yet there they are, in plain sight. Scientists insist, rather half-heartedly, that mountains are the bulging results of tectonic shifts along massive rocky plates. Mountains develop naturally over the course of many millennia, scientists say under their breaths. Most people believe that mountains aren't there at all. Even when mountains are visible, as they often are, non-believers will explain that our minds create sensory illusions to help explain what we cannot understand, like the shapes of gods and monsters in the stars, or messages in tea leaves, or government codes in cloud patterns. Mountains, real or not, ring this desert like the rim of an empty dinner plate. Scattered sparsely along the flat middle are small towns with names like Red Mesa, Pine Cliff, and, right in the center, Night Vale. Above Night Vale are helicopters, protecting citizens from themselves and others. Above the helicopters are stars, which are completely meaningless. Above the stars is the void, which is completely meaningful. Through this crowded sky, mysterious lights often pass. These are just alien spacecraft, or the auras left by interdimensional travelers. But these simple explanations are boring. The people of Night Vale often come up with elaborate stories to explain the lights to themselves. The sky once loved a certain rock, but millennia of erosion transformed the rock to dust. The sky, not understanding, still signals for its friend who abandoned it. The rock never knew about the sky. The rock only loved the wind that was slowly eroding it. Sometimes it's okay to find something beautiful without correctly understanding it. In the center of Night Vale, like in many cities, is its downtown, with the usual things a downtown has: City Hall, community radio station, hooded figures, a library, a shimmering vortex blocked off with yellow police tape, dangerous stray dogs, and propaganda loudspeakers on every corner. Beyond downtown is Old Town Night Vale, a residential and shopping area planned and developed during the booming economy of the early 1930s. After the war, the neighborhood fell into disrepair, but in recent years, it has seen a regenesis of homeowners, neighborhood shops, tall metal trees, and predatory cats. Beyond Old Town Night Vale are the sand wastes, which are exactly what you think they are. And beyond the sand wastes are the scrublands, which are sort of what you think they are. And beyond the scrublands is the used car lot, and Old Woman Josie's house, and finally, out on the edge of town, the house of Larry Leroy. Larry had lived by himself for as long as he could remember. He owned a phone which was broken and a car which sat wheelless atop four blocks of concrete out back. Hidden under the car, he had an underground shed full of canned goods and bottled water and a year's worth of pork sausage preserved in animal fat. He used to have a shotgun, but he traded it for the car without wheels, figuring a car without wheels was safer than a shotgun. Despite the friendly reminders from the Night Vale chapter of the National Rifle Association, "Guns don't kill people. Guns are the new kale. Guns are healthy as all get out," Larry never felt safe around guns. When he was in his early 20s, Larry's father took him hunting. He didn't like his father. He didn't hate him either. Once, when Larry reached into the back of his dad's pickup to grab the shotgun, a scorpion resting on the barrel had stung Larry's hand. He had distrusted guns ever since. These days, Larry actually liked scorpions. After all, they eat squirrels, which he really hated. He rarely paid much attention to the illogical way in which the human mind develops certain phobias. This evening, he bent over the shoebox on his desk. He was carefully pasting a tiny brown mustache he'd made from a sliver of tree bark to a tiny W.E.B. Du Bois's face. He still needed to build the arm-mounted laser cannon Du Bois was known for. Larry heard what sounded like the small claws of squirrels running around in his basement, and he hoped the scorpions were hungry. He turned his attention to his miniature version of the five-headed dragon named Rachel McDaniels that Du Bois often rode when speaking. Du Bois spoke from a place of moral and physical authority to the intellectuals and politicians who stood in the way of equal rights for black Americans. He also spoke from the back of a flying dragon. Larry was building a diorama celebrating Du Bois's famous defeat of the German army in 1915, depicting him and Rachel in their library, high-fiving above a copy of the Declaration of Surrender. Larry adored this war hero and great orator of civil rights. He enshrined Du Bois in fine detail in the cardboard shoebox. Larry's family never cared much for history, often telling him history didn't exist because it was no longer happening. The moment anything occurred, they would say every night at dinner, it was gone, relegated to the fiction of memory. They would say that with their heads bowed, and then they would begin eating. Perhaps he had been a rebellious youth, or perhaps he just wanted to explore the often wondrous, often tragic myth of human history. Larry adored his heroes, W.E.B. Du Bois, Helen Keller, Red Fox, Luis Valdez, Toni Morrison. He believed it was his responsibility to help carry on their legacy by enshrining their great stories and deeds so that they still felt present in the present. History is real, regardless of truth, Larry often said, not with words, but with his actions. Tiny clothing, facial hair, painted set models, most pieces no bigger than any one of Larry's fingers. They took a steady eye, a steady hand. Unlike most men, he had grown more steady as he aged, more dexterous in his lack of speed. He expertly placed Du Bois's mustache below the great intellectual's nose and set the tweezers down to begin working on the diorama's library backdrop. Larry heard a whirring hum. He felt it throughout his body. There were undulations in the waves of the noise, smooth ups and downs, easily lulling the subconscious mind of a man hard at work. The troughs and crests of sounds accelerated, soon going from steady ululations to a bumpy roar. The metal plates and cups in his hand-built kitchen were the first to start rattling, followed by the creaking of the roof against the metal trusses. He glanced at the earthquake calendar tacked to his wall. Agents from a vague, yet menacing, government agency delivered these calendars each month, sliding a manila envelope under the door in the middle of the night. According to the calendar, there was no earthquake scheduled for today. He looked down at W.E.B. Du Bois and Rachel McDaniels in their vast academic library. A drop of Larry's sweat, the size of Du Bois's head, landed on McDaniels' back, smudging the paint and knocking off the freshly glued spines. Larry wiped his brow. He didn't sweat often, even in the desert heat. "It's a dry heat," people from the desert often say to others, trying to disguise the fact that they're kidding themselves. But the heat today was unusual. He felt it not from the air, but from below his boots, and not the heat of the sun, but of friction. The sand underneath his plywood floor burned, like two worlds rubbing together. His sleeveless brown undershirt was drenched dark down its sides. He heard the crash of metal plates and cups falling out of the doorless cabinets. The ground, his house, his whole self, shook. It was not the soft, wobbling slide of a government-run earthquake. This felt like being punched from below. The desert was being pounded by a giant subterranean fist. As he stood and staggered into the living room, there was another hard thump and shake of his house. Larry tripped forward, face first, into the frame around his open front door. He wasn't afraid, but for his dioramas. He knew one day there would be an end to all of this, and long before that, there would be an end to Larry. He was not so arrogant as to refer to his own death as the end, just one of billions of ends before the end. Death is only the end if you assume the story is about you. He knew one day he would be found deceased in his home out on the edge of town. He was unbothered by this. He may not have had children, but the legacy provided by children is limited. Few people know the details of their family past their great-grandparents, and many people don't even remember that generation. Two generations of memory is all that children provide, and then everyone is forgotten. But he would leave behind stacks of writing, dioramas, and patchwork quilts. He had a handmade history, his attempt to offer immortality to his heroes, and perhaps extend his own story as well. Instead of a brief obituary in the Night Vale Daily Journal, he wanted his death to be a story of the discovery of his great collection, the work of his then-finished life. He had already written letters for Sarah Sultan, president of the Night Vale Community College, instructions to donate his dioramas to the school's art department, Leanne Hart, editor of the Daily Journal, and Cecil Palmer, host of the community radio station, an obituary he had written for himself, and also ones for Leanne and Cecil. And Michelle Wynn, owner of Dark Owl Records, who would no doubt be pleased to inherit Larry's vast collection of polka music, written, performed, and recorded himself using a concertina and a microcassette recorder. Michelle loathed any music popular enough to have been heard by more than her and the Dark Owl staff, so Larry's tunes would be welcome. According to his will, the letters were to be delivered and his belongings distributed accordingly. His artistic and academic endeavors were his children, a legacy that would hopefully last for much longer than two forgetful human generations. He could feel the bruise beginning to form on his cheek from where he ran into the doorframe. He turned back into the house. The pounding from below was bringing down his kitchen and living room. He watched as the walls and ceiling collapsed and twisted into dust and scrap. Pages of his books and personal writing scattered up toward the helicopters and stars above and fluttered lazily in the wind like unmotivated pigeons. Lurching forward, arms straight out, using the walls for balance, he rounded the corner back into his art studio. His Du Bois and McDaniel's diorama was slightly damaged but recoverable. He picked it up. The wall of other dioramas was still there. Decades of meticulous work and loving craftsmanship. His Pride and Prejudice diorama, which had been his first, still showed the inconsistencies of a neophyte, but also the bravery of a young artist. Elizabeth Bennet's sword was soaked with blood. Larry had used his own. And for her eyes, he had used polished onyx. From wherever you stood in the room, Bennet appeared to be staring you down with the passion and vengefulness this dangerous literary villain was known for. He set the Du Bois box down on the work table and walked toward his wall of dioramas. The long plexiglass windows were secured and locked over the displays. The thumping floor jostled him violently. He tugged a bit on each shelf, seeing they were safe, but needing to touch them all to believe it. Crack! The floorboard below Larry split. He lost his balance, but regained it against the support column next to the shelves. Another loud thump, and half the work table buckled into a sinkhole growing in the floor. He saw Du Bois's box sliding down toward the opening. He jumped. He rarely jumped or did anything quickly, but now he did both. He grabbed the box, then, stepping with his right foot onto the sinking table, he pushed off, hurling himself uncontrolled into the far wall, but managing to cradle the diorama of his favorite orator securely to his chest. It was silent for a long moment, just Larry breathing. He heard a drop of sweat tap the floor below him. The earth was hot. His feet were beginning to cramp. His head was light. He took Du Bois outside and set the box gently on the ground, safely away from the shaking building. He grabbed his wheelbarrow out of the ditch and raced back into the collapsing house. He tossed any important documents he could find, along with his letters to the people of Nightvale, into the wheelbarrow. He grabbed the poems and plays he had written. He rushed back into his studio, his arms straining, wheelbarrow already half full. He set his dioramas carefully atop one another in the wheelbarrow, his life's work, a delicate pyramid of paint, plastic, and paper. He heard the ceiling creak. He placed Jane Austen's masterpiece on top of the others in the wheelbarrow. As he did, a loud pop and a harsh crunch. His ears were ringing immediately. He fell, or rather slid, to his knees. The floor buckled. The empty shelves collapsed. He glanced down into the hole. He saw dirt and wood and plexiglass falling, falling and hitting nothing. In that hole he saw a deep, endless nothing. The floor tore away, the wood bending down into the hole below. He struggled to keep his boots' grip on the steeply angled floor. He gave the wheelbarrow a strong push, knowing if he didn't make it, he'd at least give the dioramas a fighting chance. The cart lurched a couple of feet and then began rolling back toward him. The pyramid of his life's work quivered, on the verge of tumbling. His boots were sliding. Larry gave one more great shove with his calves, his knees unbent, his body thrust upward. He pushed up the sloping floor, straining but eventually gaining traction and then momentum. He rolled his cart off the top edge of the pit, leaping as if from a ramp into the living room, away from the growing hole behind him. He turned the corner and ran out the front door. As daylight dwindled slowly across the desert, Larry emerged onto the patio, out toward the sunset, away from the collapsing home and toward a collapsing earth. The front lawn, mere pebbled dirt and leafless shrubs, was gone. Everything up to the ditch was an empty pit. The earth before him was completely gone, and with it, W.E.B. Du Bois and Rachel McDaniels. Larry barely had time to process what had happened when there came one more thump. He didn't know it yet, but it would be the last and the most terrible. The front few steps gave way to an implosion of sand. His palms burned as the wood handles of the wheelbarrow were wrenched from his hands. Elizabeth Bennett's eyes flashed an angry orange as she fell along with the other enshrined heroes into oblivion. He watched everything that proved he ever had existed fall into the nothing below. Behind him, he heard the remainder of his house collapse into the pit as well. He stood on a patch of wood in an open doorframe surrounded by a growing, gaping nothing. He stared at the earth dropping away around him. He stared at the stars and the void, which were falling upward, away from him. As the ground under his feet dropped away, as he started his fall toward the deep nothing below, Larry didn't believe what he was seeing. Of course, he didn't believe mountains were real either, yet there they were, in plain sight, if only for a few seconds more. 2. Nilanjana Sikdar stared at the bacteria. The bacteria did not stare back. They vibrated around without sentience. The experiment had to do with a byproduct of the bacteria, a substance that had applications as a pesticide for industrial farming. But at this moment, Nilanjana was more worried about why they seemed to mostly be growing on one side of the dish. It didn't mean anything necessarily, although it could mean something. Anything could mean something to someone, but it looked uneven. It was out of place. She wished she could nudge some of the bacteria to the other side of the dish. But that wouldn't be scientific. And anyway, bacteria are difficult to nudge. Maybe she could tilt the dish slightly, just to get some of the bacteria colonies to the bare side of the dish. Then it would be more even. It would be no more scientific than before, but it would look neater. No, she couldn't do that. Manually altering the bacteria's behavior would be wrong. She sighed. The bacteria would be uneven. She would learn to cope with this, as she had learned to cope with everything else that she had encountered in her life. Living as she had for nearly 4 years in a town like Nightvale, there was always a great deal to cope with. Hauntings by vengeful ghosts, abduction attempts by curious aliens, municipal holidays with startling casualty rates. She had learned to cope with it all. But still, the bacteria bothered her more than she would have been able to admit to anyone. She tilted the dish. She just wouldn't tell anyone. The bacteria stayed stubbornly on the left side of the dish. She made a few notes in her notebook, which was lined up so that the dish and microscope were exactly at its center line. Once she was done writing, she returned her pen to its place, flush against the sides of the pages. Her desk was otherwise bare. She didn't need anything but her experiment and her notebook in order to do her work. And if she didn't need something, then there was no reason to have it around. Her table was a gratifyingly empty rectangle, with the microscope and notebook straddling the center line. Also, a thin dribble of the growth solution, snaking its way toward the edge. "Shit," she said. "Huh?" said Louisa. She had the table next to Nilanjana. Louisa's experiment had something to do with being visibly disappointed in potatoes. And she was, even as she cocked her head toward Nilanjana, keeping up a performative scowl at the pile of spuds on her own table. Her table wasn't messy, except that any table would look messy next to Nilanjana's. Louisa's table looked messy. There was a stack of paper toppling slowly over the entire desk, and her potatoes were in a haphazard pile, placement randomly assigned so as not to affect the outcome of the experiment, whatever that was supposed to be. "No," said Nilanjana. "Nothing. Well, I just spilled. I mean, just a bit." She pointed. "I'm extremely disappointed in you," said Louisa.
"What?"
"Sorry, that was for the potatoes. I have to provide a verbal reminder of my disappointment at set intervals along with visual cues, just in case they respond mainly to sounds."
"Do they respond to sounds at all?"
"Only one way to find out," Louisa said brightly. Her face was still stern and frowning. She shook her head. "You're not living up to your potential."
"Do potatoes have a potential?"
"No, not them. You, Nils. What is that experiment you're doing anyway?"
"Ah, see, that's actually interesting. I'm adjusting the pH level of this growth material by an incremental amount each..."
"Nils, is that even science?"
"Yes."
"Is it?" "Oh, I'm still not sure what science is. That sounded more like performance art." She poked at a potato, and it rolled off to the side of the pile. She either didn't notice or didn't care. "In any case, you shouldn't be wasting your time on tiny experiments like that one. You should be working bigger, more prestigious projects. The kind of stuff that wins awards, like the Best Science Award and the This Science Was Good Award from the Society for Good Scientists. Look at me and the potatoes." She made a gesture that invited Nilanjana's gaze, but Nilanjana was already looking at them, so she widened her eyes to indicate that she was looking even harder. "Do you know how many grants I've gotten for this potato thing? All goes according to plan. I can spend the rest of my career being disappointed in these potatoes and getting all the big media attention that goes along with it." Nilanjana didn't care much for scientific grants and awards. There were many wealthy tabloid famous scientists, but that was not why she got into science. She simply wanted to study the nature of the world. She was happiest coming to the lab every day, working on her bacteria, developing fringe, non-commercial things that benefit society, like pharmaceutical drugs, or pesticides. She had been studying these bacteria for the past 3 years to develop a natural pesticide. Up until then, farmers mostly got rid of bugs by setting them on fire. But this tended to have an adverse effect on the crops the bugs lived on. She had made some breakthroughs. Earlier this year, she managed to create a spray solution that kept wood-boring beetles off of trees. But the beetles tended to scream when in contact with the spray. They screamed a lot. It was off-putting. So she was trying to refine the formula. For her, science was a process toward perfection. Every answer created new questions, branching out to more and more answers. She wanted to fill in the empty circle of human knowledge with facts and evidence, so we didn't have to explain the unexplainable with conjecture and legend. The less of life that belonged to the realm of myth, the better off humanity would be. If there were prizes or cash grants for all of this, great. But Nilanjana wasn't looking for approval. She was looking for scientific order and tidy knowledge. Right, but Louisa, see, I like this experiment. It's interesting. And if it's interesting, it's important. That's what Carlos always says. Oh, Carlos, he's a great scientist, Nils, but he doesn't have the head for the career stuff. Stick with me. I'll help you get there. Okay, yeah, but... Nilanjana indicated her dish of bacteria, which was when there was a sudden ear-crushing bang, followed by a fluorescent flash, and her hand flinched right into the dish, knocking the whole thing over. Sorry, said Mark. His station was behind them both, and he had invented a machine that was supposed to make a blinding flash followed by a startling bang. But it had been getting the order wrong for weeks now. Okay, now, goddammit, Nilanjana said. That was a month's work right there. I need a paper towel. Excuse me. Louisa shrugged. Suit yourself. Let me know if you ever want more advice. I just want what's best for you, and you're letting all of us down. That's a bit strong. We barely... No, I'm sorry, Nils. That was for the potatoes again. Nilanjana stood to get something to wipe the spreading mess on her desk. There was growth solution on practically all of a small part of the table. It was overwhelming. Mark winced apologetically as she passed him. Sorry about that. I should have sounded the warning air horn right behind you to let you know I was about to test this, but you know how it is. I got caught up in the experiment. She nodded, waving the slight away with her hand. She knew exactly how it was. She liked Mark, and was sorry his experiment wasn't going well, even if his tinkering on it was liable to cause her serious psychological or physical harm. Don't listen to her, he said as he unscrewed a hatch on his machine, trying to understand what the problem was. Its light weakly flickered, and it let out an unstartling burble. He shook his head. At least that was in the right order, he muttered. I can listen to her, but not listen to her, you know? Said Nilanjana. I'm proud of my experiment. It's about something that interests me, and it works. Or it worked. It worked until I knocked it over. She opened up the lab's emergency station, which contained a roll of paper towels and nothing else. Or I don't know. I guess maybe that's what I do, you know? I work on small experiments by myself. Maybe that's just what's in store for me. That would be okay. Whatever makes you happy, Nils. He poked at the machine with a screwdriver. Not being flippant, really, whatever makes you happy. Are you happy? I'm fine. She glanced back at the small dribble of growth solution on the table, shuddered, and spooled a large portion of the paper towel roll around her hand, tearing it off with a hard tug. I don't need to be happy when I'm fine. As she wiped the growth solution up with a huge wad of paper in her hand, she considered whether she was even fine. How was someone supposed to know that? What was the objective test of happiness, let alone fineness? What data could be collected? Could fine even be demonstrated objectively? She considered the other scientists. There were several tables around the large lab, each with a scientist working on their own experiment. Some of the experiments sparked or sang, others oozed or gelled. Only some of the experiments thought or felt. On one wall was a whiteboard with various project names and experimental observations.
Bees? Said one.
Hypothesis. Everything is frightening, and we should hide, said another. The lab was in the science district, a rough, industrial part of town, made dangerous by frequent feuds between rival groups of scientists. Astronomers and ornithologists in particular were always picking fights with each other. Street corner ambushes that would start with the reading aloud of peer-reviewed research papers and end with the thrust of a broken bottle. Nilanjana stayed out of these disputes, but it was still unsettling walking by a faint blood stain or the torn page of a thesis, marking the site of a particularly violent battle. Still, she was fine with it. She was fine with her experiment. She was fine with Louisa and Mark. She was fine sitting in a large room full of smart people she respected, even if she didn't know them well. She was fine coming to work and talking about science, or maybe just life. She was fine going home alone at night and not being in a room full of people. She was fine limiting the people she knew to select hours of the day and then restricting them from other hours of the day when she could be by herself. She was fine being an outsider. The people of Nightvale regularly reminded her she was not from here. She had always been an outsider, and this was fine. She was fine growing up a girl who liked killing bugs and looking in microscopes and organizing microbes into even patterns. She was fine not having friends who understood or liked this. She was fine not being picked on or derided, but also not being invited to parties. Maybe she wasn't happy. Maybe what she was doing wasn't important or helping anyone, but it was fine. I'm fine, she was fine with telling herself. Nilanjana, said a smooth, oaky voice. She looked up from the table, which she had been wiping over and over with the paper towels, not even noticing the motion of her arm. Carlos was standing in the door of his office. He looked frightened. No. Concerned. No. Frightened. Nilanjana, can you come in here? I need your opinion on... Just come in here, please. Carlos did not often call other scientists into his private lab. That was where he did his own special experiments, ones that involved the saving of Nightvale from the various supernatural threats that besieged it, and also where he put together construction paper collage love notes for his husband. It was all important work, and he preferred to not be disturbed. Nilanjana couldn't remember the last time she had been asked into his office. If she had known all the events that would spiral out from the conversation she was about to have, she would have felt terrified, and maybe overjoyed, and terrified all over again. She would have felt so many things she hadn't felt since coming to this strange town where she didn't quite belong. As it was, she only felt confused. Sure, she said. I'll be right in. Ugh, said Louisa, waving dismissively at her potatoes. 3. Nilanjana had no interest in Carlos, and anyway, he was married to the local community radio host, Cecil Palmer. Still, she couldn't not notice that he was, in his way, stunningly handsome. Even his frown was perfect, and he ran his hands perfectly through his perfect hair. In science, of course, there's a lot of pressure to look good. Appearances are a major part of a science career, and top scientists face all sorts of accusations of plastic surgery and unhealthy diets, a constant scrutiny in gossip magazines and tabloid blogs. But Carlos stayed out of all that. He was a beautiful person, but that never interested him much. He only cared about two things: his scientific work and his family. Nilanjana didn't know Carlos's family well. She knew his teenage niece, Janice, was born with spina bifida, and while her frequent checkups of eyes, kidneys, and spine came back healthy each time, Carlos would take days off work to be with her and his brother and sister-in-law. Nilanjana knew that his husband, Cecil, sometimes faced serious dangers as a reporter in a town as full of terrible secrets as Night Vale, and those dangers sent Carlos into a worried stupor. He would pace about the office, trying not to call the station to ask if Cecil was okay. Not much got done in the lab when Carlos fretted for Cecil's safety. She could tell when Carlos had a date night planned, because he put gel in his hair and wore his most striking lab coat. She was uncertain why Carlos wanted to talk to her now. She hoped that the problem was with his scientific work. She didn't have much to say on the subject of being in love. Not that she hadn't had boyfriends. She was a human being of adult age with an interest in other human beings, and she had been in relationships starting from high school. But she did not feel qualified to offer advice on the subject. She was just stumbling along the same as anyone. It was occasionally fun and often lonely, whether she was with someone at the time or not. Carlos interrupted this reverie by pulling down a chart that said in large letters, "Science." Today's topic of discussion is science. I've provided a visual aid. Oh, thank God. He gestured for her to sit, but she didn't like sitting much, and so she gestured that she would rather stand. And there was some gesturing back and forth that neither of them understood. Finally, Carlos sat, and she remained standing. "I know you are aware of the house," he began. "The general concept of houses?" No, sorry. The house that doesn't exist." He pulled down another chart. It had a picture of a house on it. "Yes," she said. "I know that house. It doesn't exist. It looks like it exists. Like it's right there when you look at it, and it's between two other identical houses, so it would make more sense for it to be there than not, but it doesn't actually exist," he finished. "Right. It's a weird house. Or it isn't a weird house. It's weird, but not a house. Hard to know how to talk about it." Everyone in town knew about the house that looks like it exists, but doesn't. There was a common dare among scientists to knock on the door and then run away. Carlos himself had once entered the house. He didn't talk much about this. Anytime the topic came up, he would wave it off or try to change the subject. What Nilanjana had learned from his research notes was that its interior was entirely different than that of the common prefab house it seemed to be when one peered through its windows. Seen from the inside, the house contained no furniture and no decorations, except a small black-and-white photo of a lighthouse. The house was not a house, but an entryway to a desert otherworld, vast and empty. There was a single mountain in that other world, and it was completely believable to all who saw it. At the top of the mountain was the lighthouse from the photo. There had been a cold light emanating from all around, though the sun was never visible. Hypothesis: the desert otherworld had been cold and empty, and had made Carlos feel lost to the people he loved. Carlos cared more than anything about the people he loved, and so a place with no one and nothing in it had been traumatizing for him. Ever since his return from the otherworld a few years back, everyone in the lab knew Carlos had been obsessed with the house. And like most obsessions with the truth, this had made the city council nervous. "Your job is being a scientist," the council had told him via an empty-eyed child messenger who had helpfully lunged out at him from the shower when he had gotten up to pee in the middle of the night. "So look pretty and write papers. Don't go searching around for the truth. You're a scientist, not a snoop." "Man," said Nilanjana, as he told her about the message from the council. "Yes, it was upsetting," said Carlos. "And then, of course, I was stuck with an empty-eyed child messenger, and you know how long it takes the city council to come back around and pick them up. We ended up having to give her rides to school for the next 3 weeks. We're going to her eighth-grade graduation tomorrow."
"Oh, cute."
"Super cute. But I won't let the city council dissuade me from preventing anyone else from being hurt by that other world. They've been trying to stop me." It went like this. Carlos had come up with the idea of performing measurements on the house that doesn't exist, using a wall-sized machine in his office. The machine employed radar and microwaves and lasers to take measurements, spitting out numbers and making a high-pitched whirring sound. Often, especially on hot days, the windows of the house that didn't exist were left open in the front living room, and he could try to get a reading of the distance between the house's non-existent exterior and its parallel universe interior. A check for entrances into parallel universes and laser readings of their depths are common parts of any new home inspection. And so he had just applied this construction tool to his experimental problems. If one looked through the window, it seemed like a typical living room. Armchair, settee, loudspeaker without volume control for the distribution of government propaganda, emergency backup settee, the usual stuff. But he knew this was only an optical illusion, which is a fancy scientific phrase for a lie. When he had switched his machine on, things had gone all wrong. There was a rumbling deep from below the sand of the desert. It shook the ground. It was almost like an earthquake, but not human-made, or scheduled on the municipal community calendar like a normal earthquake. The vibration and noise had made all of his readings useless. Science was meant to be hard. After all, what was science but a bunch of bored human beings trying to challenge themselves when faith became too easy? So he had set up the machine again, carefully calibrating it, and then turning it on. Again, the moment after his finger hit the switch, there'd been the rumble. The experiment was ruined. "Someone is watching me. Every time I try to do the experiment, the rumbling starts up and ruins it. Someone doesn't want this house investigated. I think whoever is trying to stop me has their own counteractive machine to disrupt my research." He pulled down a third chart. This one, a map of where the rumblings had been concentrated. A series of orange blotches in the desert surrounding the town. "Along with the seismic action to throw off my numbers, there appears to have been violent displacement of Earth. People have gone missing." "But who would want to cover up the truth?" asked Nilanjana. "Besides the secret police, the city council, the mayor, any number of world governments, and the invading forces from other worlds." "Exactly," Carlos said. "The city council is the most likely, since they had already warned me." Carlos had demanded an audience with the city council. A brave move. Whatever multi-form, extra-dimensional beast inhabited the council chambers, issuing forth smoke and brimstone and city ordinances, it had a ravenous taste for humans. But Carlos put science and his community before all other concerns, so he had taken a flame-retardant lab coat, slipped on a blindfold to keep him from the horror of seeing the writhing forms of the council, and gone to City Hall. "Who is doing this?" he had demanded.
"Doing what?"
the city council had said in many-voiced, multi-pitched, surround-sound unison.
"We've been on vacation recently. We haven't done anything. Just what are you accusing us of?"
"Ruining my experiments on the house that doesn't exist. Preventing me from understanding what I need to understand," the council had hissed.
"You were told to drop this. Our patience is limited."
"So you have been disrupting my experiments with this rumbling under the earth."
"Foolish scientist, seeker of truth. You think you are the only one interested in that house? There are many who seek to exploit the power it holds."
"What power? What people?"
"We have said too much. We should devour you. But there are influential members of the media protecting you, and it wouldn't be worth the grief we'd get from them. Flee while you have your life."
"What is the power of the house? What do you know?"
The council had roared. A moist, spongy hand had slipped around his neck. "The wordsmith warned us of what is waiting to enter our city. You are peeking through doors that should not be opened. Cease your research, or it will be ceased for you."
The wet fingers had tightened. Carlos had backed away. The fingers had loosened as he stepped, letting him go. He was left with a smell like a leaking battery, an acid smell he tasted on the back of his tongue.
"The wordsmith?" said Nilanjana.
Despite herself, she was leaning on the desk, caught up in the story.
Who is that?
Have no idea, said Carlos. Never heard that phrase before. Yet another mystery. Mystery upon mystery upon mystery.
He pulled a cord, and all three charts rolled themselves back up with a snap.
It seems that these inquiries have hit a point at which I can no longer continue.
You can't give up because the city council says you have to.
I'm afraid, Nils, that that is exactly what I have to do. He sighed and got up, looking out the window at the cracked asphalt of the strip mall where his laboratory was located. There were a few cars in the parking lot. Famished citizens stopping by for a slice from Big Rico's Pizza next door. Teenagers looking for a quiet place to make out or to stare in mutual fear at the vastness of the night sky. The unmarked black sedans full of bland-faced, besuited government agents listening to every word anyone said.
Science is a quest for truth without compromise, but science must be done within human life. And human life is entirely compromise, especially life here in our watchful little town.
He tilted his head at the black sedans. He turned back to her. He mouthed, "Do you understand?" She nodded.
Nils, I would never ask you to help me continue this experiment. I would never ask you to try to find the source of the rumbling. It would be dangerous to push on this matter. If I did ask, you would have every right to walk out that door and go back to your bacteria.
Why would you ask me, and not one of the other scientists? She asked. I mean, if you were to actually continue this experiment, which you are clearly not.
From outside his office, there was a sudden loud bang and a bright flash visible below the door. They could hear Louisa shout, "You're such a disappointment!" It was unclear if that was directed at Mark or at a potato. Carlos glanced briefly toward the door and then back at Nilanjana. He smiled at her and held out his hand. She took his hand and gave a knowing nod. An experiment that was being prevented on a house that did not exist. A mystery the city council was afraid of, and a person or entity going by the name Wordsmith. It seemed opaque, impossible. But the study of science had taught her how to handle the impossible. Collect data, form hypotheses, test the hypotheses, use what you learn to collect more data. And soon, the impossible would reveal itself to be a thin and pliable barrier. She would start with the most objective, measurable part of the story, the rumblings out in the desert.
"I am afraid I cannot help you," she said, going to the door. "If you'll excuse me, I need to get rid of my bacteria and go to the desert. I have some personal matters I need to attend to."
"Thank you," he mouthed. She swept her useless, ruined experiment off her desk into the bin. Louisa, throwing her a confused, sideways glance, briefly breaking her frozen expression of disappointment, and went out to her car. Nilanjana found herself laughing as she turned on the engine. She laughed with real joy, without understanding why she felt that joy. What was she getting herself into? She laughed happily. She had no idea.
4. Daryl Ramirez told the barista who overfilled his Americano that it was totally fine. It could happen to anyone, and he shouldn't beat himself up about it. But the barista glared at him and rolled his eyes, wiped away the coffee in a few quick, angry movements, and then thrust the cup at him. Daryl found himself apologizing, even though it was his coffee that had been spilled. Daryl was legitimately sorry. He had meant it all earnestly, but something in his demeanor made other people assume he was being sarcastic or false. What had been an honest attempt to make the barista feel better about his mistake had instead come across as a taunt about the barista's inability to correctly do what is, despite Barista Local 485's constant and loud insistences, a pretty simple job. He thanked the barista and then said, "Believe in a smiling God, my friend."
while making a circling motion with his upright fist. But the barista was already making someone else's drink. It was his years in the church that had done it, Daryl thought. The church urged all its members to present a happy face to the world, which had the noble intention of spreading joy, but ultimately valued outside presentation over an honest connection to a person's feelings, which meant that even when he actually felt a positive feeling, it tended to come off false to anyone outside of the joyous congregation of the smiling God. Or maybe, he thought, he was just bad at connecting with people, at least in person. He had, early on in his life, taken to writing notes when he had something important to say, so that his inflection and facial expression wouldn't affect the message he was conveying. Nilanjana looked up when she heard his voice, and, seeing the barista's reaction, assumed that Daryl had been yelling at him. Yelling at baristas wasn't uncommon in Night Vale. This was not because the baristas were bad at their jobs or unlikable people. Quite the opposite. Night Vale's barista district was densely populated with talented coffee makers and aficionados. There was a single block of Galloway Road that had six coffee shops on it. For a desert community, people took their hot coffee quite seriously. It was because of the general politeness and the talent of the baristas that customers were so hard on them. With so many coffee shops, it was a consumer's market. Plus, it is basic human nature to treat polite people worse than rude people. It is easier to assert dominance over a person unlikely to fight back with much force. Rude people tend to fight hard, and it's not worth stirring them up. Nilanjana watched Daryl, whom she was pretty sure she had met before, put a single drop of cream into his coffee and then carefully stir. She related to his level of exactness and order. She resented him for it as well. She had gone to the desert directly from the lab, but the location where Carlos had detected rumbling recently was crawling with agents from a vague yet menacing government agency. This wasn't surprising. Agents from whatever agency it was tended to closely investigate and document any new activity in town. They would be done soon, and she would have the site to herself. In the meantime, she had gone to her favorite coffee shop, the Spiky Hammer, to get out of the heat and to sit doing nothing at a table, so she wouldn't have to sit doing nothing in her car. Her coffee was huge, a 20-ounce filter coffee, espresso takes too long, with exactly 2 tablespoons of milk and 3 packets of sugar. Sometimes she would put in a half teaspoon of whatever spices the coffee shop had out, cinnamon, nutmeg, paprika, metal shavings, etc. She just wanted hot caffeine, and any extra flavors that could make the stuff drinkable were a bonus. She brought her own measuring spoons to coffee shops to ensure the precision of her routine. The notes from this morning's meeting with Carlos were neatly set out in front of her, her pen lying across her hand, which was lying across the page, as if writing. But she was lost in no thought, staring at no one thing. She had been watching Daryl, trying to decide whether she knew him somehow. His intense awkwardness with the barista, but then his kindness, and then his apparent religious zeal. Thinking about the myriad ways she might have previously met a stranger, her mind drifted. She had been looking at him, but now she was staring at the empty space where he had been, a series of flyers pinned to a bulletin board. One of them read, "Learn to play the guitar." And then, in smaller print, "According to City Ordinance 12.546B, enacted on August 1st, the crime of not knowing how to play guitar is punishable by a maximum fine of $12,000 and 3 years in prison. Learn to play the guitar today." There was another that had a picture of a bike on it. "Have you seen this bike? It never existed in this universe, in this timeline. If you have seen this bike, please contact me immediately. I need to return home." There was no name or contact information. She heard Daryl's voice again. He was talking to another patron in the cafe. He was making that circling fist gesture and then handing them a small brochure. He was smiling meaningfully. The other person was smiling without meaning. They said, "Stop it," and then covered their ears and shook their head until Daryl stopped talking and walked away. He approached multiple people in the cafe, each time asking, "Do you know about the smiling god?" And then doing the fist thing. One person made a fist gesture back to him. They made eye contact and hummed a single low note in unison for 10 seconds before breaking off and continuing with their activities as if they had not seen each other at all. Daryl glanced at his watch and then started a conversation with another stranger. The watch reminded Nilanjana of how she knew Daryl. About 2 years ago, she and a fellow scientist, Connie, were doing a study on time, examining clocks and watches they'd purchased at various stores across town. Daryl worked at one such store. Watch yourself. He had disagreed with her that time was weird. She had tried to explain the science to him, showing him charts and digital models which demonstrated that each unit of time stays the same, and that time moves forward for people in most of the world, but that in Night Vale, it was changing constantly, sometimes minutes going backward or skipping forward, moving differently for each person. Some people would stay 19 years old for centuries without aging. Nilanjana and Connie had been studying a few such extreme cases, but Daryl was impervious to logic. He believed only what he felt was true. Time was totally normal. She returned to her notes and plan of action for studying the rumbling in the desert. But she was still replaying those old, frustrating conversations about time in her mind. Distracted, she bumped her coffee, reaching for her notes, and let out a slight yelp. People in the coffee shop looked at Nilanjana. She had been in this town 4 years, or it had felt like 4 years. Time, despite Daryl's insistence, was weird here, and so she had no idea exactly how long it had been since her arrival. "Interloper!" cried one person. Another followed suit. They were pointing at her. "Interloper!" came another shout. The fuss didn't build much past that. It was a weekday morning. People at work, lots of things on their minds. Getting into a frenzied mob was not top of their list. Besides, a few of these people knew Nilanjana. She'd been to the Spiky Hammer many times. There was no way they hadn't seen her in the years she'd lived in Night Vale. Still, even if they had recognized her, they had pointed and shouted. She'd come to this town for the same reason all scientists came here. Because it was the most scientifically interesting place in America. And it had not disappointed in that regard. But there was also a real sense of community. People belonged here and loved each other and knew their neighbors. And it was on this count that she felt she was not getting the full experience. Even after 4 years, she found herself confused by simple things that longtime residents took for granted. But why are writing implements outlawed? She would ask. And Michelle at Dark Owl Records, or Francis Donaldson, who owned the Antiques Mall, or whomever she was talking to at the time, would give her a funny look and say, "Because they're illegal." Then Nilanjana would ask why all the road signs had been replaced by tired city workers waving traffic instructions using semaphore flags. And the person she was talking to would sigh and say, "Why is the sky blue? Why is the moon fake? Why anything?" Or else would just point at her and start chanting, "Interloper!" She'd ask Carlos about it. "You're not from here either. You must get this interloper shit all the time. What's these people's deal?" Carlos said he didn't get the interloper stuff much since he'd started dating Cecil. And once they had gotten married, it had stopped completely.
"Guess I'm finally one of them,"
he said, in an off-handed way that manifested in Nilanjana's chest as a pang of jealousy. He had gone on to explain that the interloper thing was their form of a friendly greeting. He had once sneezed in an ice cream shop only to be surrounded by a dozen shouts of "interloper," followed by the small crowd picking him up and carrying him through the streets. He had been terrified.
but then they got tired and set him down several blocks away. It was kind of the Night Vale equivalent of "bless you," Carlos had told her.